us the cultural context, it gives us the political intrigue, and what it's doing is it's really just marking out the territory, marking out the location of what is developing here, in order to let us see the practical nature of what God is doing. Because God uses normal, practical, physical means to bring about divine interventions. That's why we read later on in the chapter of the flies and the bees. Everyday things, but just like the plagues in Egypt, and just like the fiery serpents in the wilderness, God takes the normal, natural environment and multiplies it to the extent that it becomes unusual. It becomes something strange, out of the normal, extraordinary or supernatural. So in chapter 7, we're getting this concept of where it's happening and who's involved in it, and then we will be discovering as we go through the other chapters leading up to the end of chapter 12 how God actually puts everything into place, slots it into place, and then brings it all together so that we can see clearly who is doing what to whom and for what reason. And so these countries will be emerging, and we'll see, in a sense, their hand as we go through from chapter 7. And that really starts in chapter 8, as we'll see possibly next study. But just to bring our thoughts to a conclusion with this seventh chapter, we want to look in the main at three things that God is doing. In the midst of the uncertainty, and it's really Judah that the prophet Isaiah has a concern for, he is aware of their fears and their anxieties, particularly when in the first part of chapter 7, it becomes obvious that the northern kingdom of Israel and also Syria have intentions. In verse 1, you read, to make war against it, that is against Jerusalem. So neighboring kingdoms cannot plan or prepare for conflict in the south without the south being aware of it. And so when you come down into verse 4, the prophet is saying to Judah, and particularly to King Ahaz, in verse 4, say to him, take heed and be quiet, do not fear or be faint-hearted. That's one thing to say that. It's another matter to actually concede to that and to obey that instruction. But God is saying, don't worry, I will do the fighting for you. See, take heed and be quiet. God has it all under control. But as we go down through the chapter, we will see that even though the evidence is already established, God has made his promise, his covenant promise with Judah, and he will not forsake that promise. Yet when all is said and done, King Ahaz has not turned out to be a faithful king. And the question now is, will a faithful less king jeopardize the covenant promise of God? Will it result in God withdrawing and allowing Israel to march on Jerusalem and captivate the people and all of these things of devastation. Will God allow that? Because the king is sinful and has, in a sense, denied the very promise that God has made. Now, we know that the Bible clearly tells us that God will not forsake his promise. Regardless of what you and I may think or may do, no matter how we respond or how we act, God will protect his promise, he will protect his people, and he will protect his purpose. And now the prophet Isaiah goes to great lengths to establish that rule and that insight into the mind and the heart of King Ahaz. Up in verse 7, God tells the king that whatever their intention may be, it will not come to pass. It's as simple as that. The world will never overshadow or overthrow the purpose of God. Nations might rise up against nation. There could be wars and rumors of wars all over the world. And these things will agitate, they will frustrate, but they will never conquer the purpose of God. What God intends will always be fulfilled. That is the work of the sovereign God. And the prophet is establishing that now in the mind of King Ahaz. So these two kings that are mentioned up in the first verse of the chapter, we have Jotham, the son of Uzziah, the king of Judah. We have Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the king, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel. And these two kings, that is Rezin and Pekah, are now becoming enemies of King Ahaz, the king of Judah, the southern kingdom, and to challenge God's promise, lineage of David, and they are endeavoring to overthrow that promise by conquering. And in verse 6, to set up a rival king, they control the south as well as in the north. But look how God speaks of them. Verse 4, do not fear or be faint-hearted, for these two stubs of smoking firebrands, for the fierce anger of Rezin and Syria, the son of Remaliah. So God says, don't panic, don't fear, don't fret, don't worry. Regard them as smoldering embers. And sooner or later, they will die out and there will be nothing. In fact, verse 8, 65 years is all that their reign of terror will last. And then it will come to an end. And down in verse 9, the promise is that God will establish his purpose. Now, when we look at the effects of all of this, and we look at the source of it all, there is one point that we cannot afford to miss. And I want to take you back to 2 Kings chapter 2 Kings 15. And here we have an insight into what is actually taking place here. And this will become important to our thinking in just a moment. Let's go to 2 Kings chapter 15, and let me read verse 13. To take particular note of this very carefully, underline, in those days the Lord began to send Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah the son of Remaliah against Judah. So we need to read that verse alongside verse 1 of Isaiah chapter 7. See? We read that they went up to Jerusalem to make war against it. Now, why did they go up to Jerusalem to make war against it? The answer is because God sent them. So here is the thing that you feared. And it is God who is the strategy. God is sending the armies of the north, the northern kingdom and Syria, in to attack Jerusalem. Now we have to ask, well, why is God doing this? Well, let's jump over to 2 Chronicles. Second Chronicles chapter 28. And we'll read the first six verses. Ahaz, that is the king of Judah, was 20 years old when he became king. And he reigned 16 years in Jerusalem. And he did not do what was right in the sight of the Lord, as his father David had done. For he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel, and made molded images for the Baals. He burned incense in the valley of the son of Hinnom, and burned his children in the fire, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. So here is the land that God had promised, that God had delivered. They had taken possession of it. In order to do that, they had to drive out the enemy and put to flight every pagan form of worship. Their worship was to be a pure worship of a holy and a sovereign God. But here is King Ahaz of the royal line of David, the line that God has promised to bless and establish. And what does he do? He disobeys every proven mark and step and example of obedience to the will of God. He has removed the landmarks that clearly established the rules of engagement as the people of God. Let's read a little more. Verse 4. He sacrificed and burned incense on the high places, on the hills, and under every green tree. Therefore the Lord his God delivered him into the hand of the king of Syria. They defeated him, carried away a great multitude of them as captives, and brought them to Damascus. Then he was also delivered into the hand of the king of Israel, who defeated him with a great slaughter. For Pekah, the son of Remaliah, killed 120,000 in one day, all valiant men, because they had forsaken the Lord God of their fathers. Now, this attack that we've just read of in 2 Chronicles 28 had taken place some years prior to this warning that the prophet Isaiah is giving. But has King Ahaz learned his lesson? He has not. He continues. He persists in his disobedience. And so, God is going to teach him another lesson. And this time, the land will be devastated almost to the point of being so overthrown and overcome and overgrown that it will never, ever recover. But God has made a promise. And while he brings the people low, he will not forsake them, nor will he forsake his promise. So with this warning of impending judgment, there is the promise of hope. And you will see that in the verses we looked at last week, which are the verses 14 and verse 16 of Isaiah chapter 7. We have the promise of hope in verse 14. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Chapter 9, he brings up that same theme. He elaborates upon it. And you will see in chapter 9 that he brings in this thought of the royal line of David. Unto us a child is born, verse 6 of chapter 9. Unto us a son is given, and the government will be upon his shoulder, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end. There will be resins or picas to interrupt the peace of the land, because the king on the throne will be Jesus. And that's the ultimate message of hope that he is bringing to Judah. Look at verse 7. Of the increase of his government and peace there will be no end, upon the throne of David and over his kingdom, to order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever. The zeal of the Lord of hosts will perform this. It's guaranteed. It is flawless, and it will be perfect in its execution. So, the prophet now breaks in upon this gloom with this message that God's people, in this case, need to keep in mind that while they may be under the pressure, God may come in judgment, and that judgment will be severe, that ultimately God will bring glory back into the land, and the king will reign in peace. And then in verse 16, we have the other thought. Before the child shall know to refuse the evil, choose the good, the lamb that you dread will be forsaken by both her kings. And verse 65 has already been mentioned in verse 8. And when we go over into the book of Amos and read in chapter 3, we discover that that was when the prophecy was first given, and right to the end of the rule of the kings that are mentioned in the first verse of the first chapter, If you've done your homework at home, you will know that that came to a period of 65 years. So that becomes the setting. And the thought in that 16th verse is that before the children born in this generation grow up, they will have seen the demise of the king of Israel, the kingdoms in the north, and the king of Syria, those who were mentioned in chapter 7 and in verse 1. So here is the message of hope that relates again back to the covenant promise of God. Now let's just round off our thoughts by looking through the last part of chapter 7. And notice how God will bring this all about. Verse 17, "The Lord will bring the king of Assyria upon you and your people and your father's house. Days that have not come since the day that Ephraim departed from Judah." And as we have noted, because Ephraim was the largest of the 10 tribes in the north, Israel, which is the northern kingdom, is very often in the Bible referred to simply on Ephraim. So when the Bible talks of Ephraim, it is referring to the 10 tribes in the north, the northern kingdom. And so here we're told that the king of Assyria, not Syria, but Assyria, will be the cause of this period of devastation that they have not witnessed before, nor since the time that Ephraim, or the northern kingdoms, departed from Judah, and the nation of Israel was divided. So God establishes now not only his covenant promise and his divine intentions, his sovereign will, in continuing to maintain that heritage, but he is now also demonstrating that there will be a period and a process of judgment that will be extensive and will be extreme. And verse 17 brings that thought through. Now, this is the first time, you may have noticed, that Assyria has actually been named as the aggressor. God has simply been telling Judah, or King Ahaz, that there will be a station, but he now names the direction from which it will come and the one who will be the instigator, it would appear, of it. Go back to chapter 5 for a moment, and of Isaiah, chapter 5, and look at verse 26. "He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar, and will whistle to them from the end of the earth. Surely they shall come with speed swiftly. No one will be weary or stumble among them, no one will slumber or sleep, nor will the belt of their loins be loosed, nor the strap of their sandals be broken, whose arrows are sharp and all their bows bent." That means that they're ready for action. "Their horses' hoofs will seem like flint." In other words, they will travel swiftly over the hard and rough terrain, unflinching in the pursuit of their intended judgment of Judah. "Their wheels like a whirlwind," so they'll have almost a supernatural speed that will get them on their journey. "Their roaring will be like a lion. They will roar like young lions." Yes, they will roar and lay. "They will carry it away safely. No one will In that day they will roar against them like the roaring of the sea, and if one looks to the land, behold, darkness and sorrow, and the light is darkened by the clouds. So they are told exactly what's going to happen, but they have not, up until this point, been told how that will come about or who will be involved in that process. So here in verse 17 of chapter 7, the king of Assyria is now set out, clearly defined as being the one who will bring this all about. Now, look at verse 18. And here we're now getting into more detail of the events. It shall come on that day that the Lord will whistle for the fly that is in the farthest part of the river Egypt. So now we've got down in the south, we have Egypt, and God is going to whistle for the flies to come up from Egypt and torment the people and devastate the land. Now we read a little bit more. And for the bee that is in the land of Assyria. So now we've got in the south Egypt, in the north Assyria, and little Judah is in the middle. And now, if you look at that verse, you'll see that from Egypt, it will be the flies. Well, flies aren't really, but they are a nuisance. You don't want them at your barbecue. But the bee isn't only a nuisance, it can be dangerous because it has a bit of a sting with it. Now, it's interesting to note that after mentioning Egypt alongside Assyria, we read no more of Egypt until we come through into chapter 57, and then they emerge again. So the concept is that Egypt is simply used to join with Assyria to bring about a strategy of war, to draw the net around Judah so that the entire land, not just the northern part, but the entire land is so surrounded that there can be no escape for the devastation within the land. God is using Egypt and Syria, or Assyria, to bring about that devastation. Now, if you look at your map today, you'll see how the modern map lines up. And we have these countries in our current modern day surrounding Israel or Judah. And we just need to keep our eyes on that and look for the flies and the bees. Let's just run a few little thoughts further into that. In that day, as we have noticed, is used specifically to refer to the current time, that is the period of those 65 years that have been outlined, that this is all going to take place then. There is a projection forward eschatologically to the last days, and that's where we need to keep our eyes on the scene. Now, chapter 7, verse 19, through into chapter 8, in fact, all through chapter 8 to the final verse 22, we see a description of the devastation that's caused by this invasion. Just look at the final verse of chapter 8. Then they will look to the earth and see trouble and darkness, gloom of anguish, and they will be driven into darkness. Now, if you remember what we read back in back in chapter 5, where they were told of what was about to happen, but not told who would bring that about. You'll remember there that the last verse of that prophecy related to the darkness that would come over the land. Let me just very quickly go through some of this with you. Notice, first of all, God is doing. Over in chapter 5 of Isaiah, verse 26, verse we read is, He, that is God, and we just go up to the first part of verse 25 to see not only who, but why God is doing this. Therefore, the anger of the Lord is aroused against his people. So now in verse 26 we read, He will lift up a banner to the nations from afar. That simply means that God will get their attention. God will put it in their heart to move against his people, Judah. So he first thing he does is he raises the flag to get their attention. And then back over into chapter 7 and in verse 18, he whistles for the fly from Egypt and he whistles for the bee from Assyria. So Assyria becomes the main focus, and it's only when we get into chapter 52 that Egypt reappears. If you look at verse 4 of chapter 8, we read, For before the child shall have knowledge to cry, My father and my mother, the riches of Damascus and the spoil of Samaria will be taken away before the king of Assyria. Verse 7. Now therefore, behold, the Lord brings up over them the waters of the river, strong and mighty, the king of Assyria and all his glory. He will go up over all his channels. See, no mention of Egypt. From this point on, it is Assyria and the king of Assyria that's outlined as creating all of this devastation. Now, just come back over into Deuteronomy chapter 1. And Deuteronomy chapter 1. And the key verse we want to note is verse 44. And just to give you a little picture, this description that the prophet Isaiah gives is not a new one. He's drawing, in a sense, on old material. But there's a reason for it, and it comes out here in Deuteronomy 1, verse 44. We've often mentioned that one of the important rules of Bible interpretation we call the first cause, the principle of the first cause. If you want to know what a text or a phrase or a word, if you go back and try and find where it first appears in the Bible, it gives you, normally it gives you a good idea as to what it is. And here is a prime example of that. So here in Deuteronomy 1, verse 44, we read, And the Amorites who dwelt in that mountain came out against you and chased you as bees do and drove you back from Seir to Horma. So that's the connection. Isaiah 7 and in verse 18, when God whistled for the bees to come, this was the intention, that the bees would drive them back and would cause them pain and suffering. So the army of Assyria is described as being like a swarm of bees, vicious and relentless. And verses 18 and 19 of chapter 7 of Isaiah show the devastation. They will come, and all of them will rest in the desolate valleys and in the clefts of the rocks and on the thorns and in all pastures. So it doesn't matter where you go, there will be bees. There will be no escaping them. And then in verse 20, we notice the subtlety of the destruction here. In the same day, the Lord will shave with a hired razor with those from beyond the river with the king of Assyria, the head and the hair of the legs, and will also remove the beard. And that refers to just the complete desolation of the land. It will be stripped bare of everything. But here is the key word. Here's the key word. In the same day, verse 20, the Lord will shave with a razor. What kind of razor? A hired razor. Hired. Like you go out and you hire a razor because you don't have one of your own. You go and you hire one. So what's the significance of this? Well, come with me to 2 Kings chapter 16. 2 Kings. And verses 7 and 8. So Ahaz, that's the king of Judah, sent messengers to Tiglath-Pileser, king of Assyria, saying. So he's about to do something now because in verse 6, he's under threat from the northern kingdoms and from Syria. So what does he do? Well, here he sends word to the king of Assyria. I am your servant and your son. Come up and save me from the hand of the king of Syria and from the hand of the king of Israel who rise up against me. Come and help me. So what does he do? Verse 8. And Ahaz took the silver and gold that was found in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the king's house and sent it as a present to the king of Assyria. He paid the king. Hired the king of Assyria to defend him. And what does the king of Assyria do? He takes the gifts, he takes the money, and he marches on Judah instead of Assyria and Israel. So when the prophet here uses that term, in the same day the Lord will shave with a hired razor, the irony is that it was Ahaz who actually did the hiring. And so God is taking the very thing that he thought he could use as a safety measure, a defense against the judgment of God. God actually takes the very thing and uses it as an instrument or weapon of judgment. And how often do we see that happening? The very thing that we want is the thing that we shouldn't have because it becomes a judgment to us. So we have now, coming in towards the end of the chapter, an outline as to the devastation. Look at verse 21 and 22. It shall be in that day that a man will keep alive a young cow and two sheep. So it shall be from the abundance of milk they give that he will eat curds. For curds and honey everyone will eat who is left in the land. Just relate that, without going into it now, just relate that verse 22 back to verse 15, curds and honey he shall eat. That is, the children will grow up eating curds and honey. Why? Because God has devastated the land. And there are no vegetables being grown, no crops in the fields. Plenty of honey because of the bees. And then verses 23 and 24, the final thought. It shall happen in that day that wherever there could be 1,000 vines worth 1,000 shekels of silver, it will be for briars and thorns. What a waste. Now, prime land that could be for 1,000 vines, and yet it's worthless, full of briars and thorns. And the next verse, with arrows and bows, men will come there, because all the land will become briars and thorns. They come to try and catch the wildlife that's now taken over and is living in prime land. So food will be scarce, and the land will return to the wild. And we will be seeing more of that as we go through these next chapters. But keep in mind that right in the middle of this very depressing passage comes the confirmation of the promised child that will rule upon the throne of David forever and forever. Amen. And God willing, we'll come back next week for a little bit more.